You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you all for coming to this event of the Open Society Fellowship Program. It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce our newest Open Society Fellow, Mark Hertzgaard, who is working, as you know, on climate change, and who is just back from China on his way to Africa as part of the fellowship. Mark is an old friend, and so it's a treat to know that he'll be on board here in New York intermittently throughout the year of his fellowship program, his fellowship term. But first I want to tell a little bit of a story about some of the cogitations we go through in the fellowship program. We have several different talent streams that provides the applicants for our program. We have activists, we have scholars, we have journalists, documentary filmmakers, photojournalists, and people, practitioners in other fields. One of the hurdles for journalists, I think, is that journalists are by nature dilettantes. They graze in a lot of different subject areas. They sample. They switch from one subject to another as their editors' enthusiasms shift. So I think that journalists probably face maybe an extra obstacle as they apply for this fellowship program, because we require a level of expertise and understanding and longevity and familiarity with a subject area before it makes sense to launch them on the, you know, the ambitious program that they have laid out in their proposal. And from that perspective, Mark Hertzgaard is an ideal Open Society Fellow, because even though his range is extremely broad, I've come to know over the years that his views, his ability to probe deeply within a subject sets him apart from the overwhelming majority of journalists covering stories on a daily basis. I met Mark back in 1993 when I was an editor at Harper's Magazine. Mark had just done a story for us on Bush Sr., who had been a Navy pilot during World War II, and one of the unexplored rumors from Bush Sr.'s past was the allegation that as a Navy pilot he had strafed, if memory serves, Japanese lifeboat in the South Pacific in 1944. And Mark got hold of the documents and basically did a kind of textual exegesis of those documents and came out with some remarkable stuff. I had known Mark's name from his book on the press during the Reagan years called On Bended Knee. And it was a revelation for me, because I, along with a lot of others, I think, felt that the press had been particularly feckless and craven during the Reagan administration. But what Mark's book showed as a culmination of years of researching how media coverage of that administration, particularly Reagan's first term, came about, was that this was the outcome of a directed policy from the hands of people like Mike Deaver and David Gergen. It was not happenstance. It was not a kind of professional laziness. It was orchestrated from the very top. I think I've taken the lessons of On Bended Knee with me through various administrations since then, and I think it was a very valuable roadmap in the second Bush administration as well. But that work, including the work he did for Harper's, was evidence of Mark's longitudinal approach to journalism. Mark has been working on environmental issues since, well, probably around then, probably since the early 90s, if not before, the late 80s, if not before. I came across a piece he did for Vanity Fair on the murder of Petra Kelly, the founder of the German Green Party, that was, that still holds up in its analysis of the sort of star-crossed fortunes of the mainstream environmental movement and its first generation. In 2000, he wrote this book, Earth Odyssey, which this came out well before anybody was talking about climate change, and well before most environmental writers were really taking environmental issues on a global scale. He travels to Thailand to to Sudan, to China, as a way of exploring what he called, what he describes as our environmental future. And the issues that he comes up with anticipates a lot of the work that he's going to be doing as an Open Society Fellow. This book, too, contains revelations that I think of as formative, at least in my own perspective and understanding of climate change and the complexities that, that often go unreported on. His talk today, and I'm going to be quiet in a minute, is about adaptation and mitigation. They are competing ways of approaching the question of climate change. Mark is one of the foremost journalists to argue that adaptation needs to be taken a great deal more seriously than it has been. So, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mark Hertzgard and to remind you that this event will be recorded for posterity as a podcast on the Open Society Fellowship website. So when the Q&A starts, please wait for the microphone, speak in the microphone, and if you don't mind identifying yourself, that would be great. Many thanks. And thanks very much also to Mark.
Well, thank you, Brother Hubble. I'm happy to be here and happy to be part of this community now. I have, as a journalist, observed the work of the Open Society Institute for quite a few years, never expecting to be part of it, but I am glad to be part of it for this coming year, and I hope that I can contribute to each of your work. I do think that climate change is going to be the defining issue of this century, and it is going to affect our work and our lives in ways that we have not yet even begun to imagine. And one of my goals in this project and in the book that I'm writing now is to try and prepare all of us as parents, as citizens, as policymakers, as journalists, for the events that are about to unfold and that are unfolding, in fact, even now with unexpected speed, with a particular focus on poor people around the world, which is to say about half of the human population, who are going to be hit especially hard by climate change. And it brings it immediately to a question of justice, because, of course, they had less than nothing to do with why we are overheating the planet. My contention in this book is that we're in a very different fight on global warming than most of us realize. And that is in part because my own business of the media is still playing catch-up on this issue, especially in the United States. As Steve mentioned, I've been covering climate change around the world now for 20 years, and it is remarkable how different the discussion is in the United States of America than it is, especially in Europe. Even now, things are a little bit better in the last few years. The Americans are catching up, but we remain behind. Hopefully that will change as time goes forward. There has been an explosion of awareness, especially since Hurricane Katrina and former Vice President Gore's movie came out and the media focus around that. But to date, the focus of the media and the public discussion in general has overwhelmingly been on what I call the front end of the problem, which is reducing greenhouse gas emissions, going green, to use the colloquial phrase. Mitigation, to use the scientific phrase. That's when scientists talk about mitigation, what they mean is activities that are intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So if you put a solar panel on your house, that's mitigation. If you eat less meat, that is mitigation. Turns out that agriculture, and especially meat eating, is one of the biggest contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. It is all to the good, let me not be misunderstood here, that we are focusing more on mitigation. It is a shame, and I will argue in my book, indeed, a crime, that we did not focus on this as much as we should have over the last 20 years. And as a result, we're in a very deep hole. We have got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions a lot faster than anything that is now on the table. If we don't, All of the discussion about adapting to climate change is going to sound pretty trite. So we have to do that as much as possible. There, of course, is a very big meeting in December of this year in Copenhagen, where the world's governments are going to come together to try and negotiate and agree a successor to the Kyoto Protocol. So, Godspeed for all of that and for all of the non-official efforts that arguably may be even more effective over the long term to reduce emissions. We do need all of that and more. But that is not going to be sufficient. And that side of the argument just has not gotten the attention that it deserves. Perhaps the most fiendish fact about climate change is that we cannot turn it off, at least not anytime soon. Once you have triggered it, the inertia of the Earth's climate system, the chemistry and the physics of how greenhouse gases operate, means that you have committed the planet to a certain level of warming, and that the temperatures are going to keep going up for quite a long time. Since we're living here in New York City, I thought that maybe I would just share with you guys a little bit of what you can look forward to. Your government, your city government, is one of the few that has actually begun to look into this with a very good team of people up at Columbia. And they've looked at the, let's just take one particular example. I'll leave out the sea level rise, but let's just talk about the weather, the heat and humidity index. And I share your pain here because I'm going to be back here for a month, and later this summer I'll be on premises from the last 2 weeks of July and the first 2 weeks of August. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the heat and humidity index that you probably hear about over the news. In New York City today, there's an average of 14 days a year when the heat and humidity index is over 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That, of course, measures the effects of both temperature and humidity. So you feel, even if the temperature may be 87, if there's enough humidity, it feels like it's over 90. So right now, your lives are 2 weeks of that kind of unpleasant experience. Because of this inertia of the system, of the climate system that I mentioned, by the 2020s, so about 10 years from now, 15 years from now, instead of 2 weeks a year, you will be having that 4.5 weeks a year, 32 days a year in the summer. It's going to be over 90 degrees. And by the 2050s, instead of 2 weeks a year, it will be 7 weeks a year. 7 weeks a year. And, of course, this pales in comparison to what people are going to experience in Bangkok, Shanghai, and various other cities around the world. The Asia Development Bank came out with a report last week warning that looking at what's going to happen in Manila and a number of these other Southeast Asian cities, they say, look, it's pretty hot there now in the summers, and in the future it will be, the quote was, it will be like an oven. So these are some of the specific impacts that, again, I emphasize, they are already locked into the system. And there are some things that we can do to deal with them, but right now we're barely even talking about the necessity to do that. My argument here is that the problem of climate change has undergone a paradigm shift from something that was a distant, hypothetical possibility, scary, but not yet here, to something that is here, now, and guaranteed to get worse, perhaps a lot worse, before we can turn it around. If we're going to turn it around, if we're going to live through this experience as a civilization, as a species, we humans need to undergo a paradigm shift of our own in how we understand this problem and how we combat it. I do think, genuinely, that there is still time, if we hurry, for us to change the way we think and to change the way our leaders and policymakers and opinion makers think about this problem, and therefore change the way that we combat the problem. If we don't, it will be a very rough road. But if we do, I think there is still time for us to give our kids And I say this as the father of a four-year-old daughter, our kids and their kids, and crucially, the natural ecosystems that we all depend on this planet. We need to give them all the best possible chance of adapting to these impacts that are now locked in. It's no surprise, I think, that most of us aren't thinking this way yet about climate change. I know for me, I have been covering the story for 15 years before I was awakened to this. And where it happened was by a man named David King, Sir David King, who was the chief science advisor to the British government for the first, from 1999 till just last year. And I went to interview him right after Hurricane Katrina. I was on assignment for Vanity Fair to do the cover story for what became their first green issue, which did not get green lighted, by the way, until Hurricane Katrina. That was our kind of wake-up call in this country. And I went to see David King in October of 2005, and I rather immodestly thought when I walked into that meeting, well, I know a lot about global warming. I've been covering it since 1989. I'd spent most of the 1990s traveling around the world to write that book, about 6 years of travel, and had been in all the different continents and had seen it on the ground and had seen the coal-fired power plants in China and so forth and so on. I had been to the Earth Summit in 1992 in Brazil, a rather remarkable meeting, and had watched the heads of government and heads of state, including the first President Bush, sign the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is still the governing treaty in this area. It is the sort of parent treaty to the Kyoto Protocol that you've heard more about. In that treaty, and it's a very significant point to understand, the goal of the international community was always to stop dangerous climate change, to stop global warming before it triggered dangerous climate change. That was what they signed on to in that treaty. Now let me back up here a minute, because for most of us, global warming and climate change are the same thing, because again, the media has done, I think, a very poor job of explaining the difference. But global warming is more or less what it sounds like. That's the measurement of the temperatures going up, and let's even specify that we're talking about man-made global warming here. Natural global warming has been going on for eons, and a very good thing it is, because otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here. Without the natural greenhouse effect on this planet, it would be freezing, way, way, way below zero, and no life. But of course, man-made global warming refers to how human activities, especially since the Industrial Revolution, have put an additional amount of emissions up into the atmosphere that are containing and enhancing that natural greenhouse effect and raising global temperatures. That issue got onto the international agenda in 1988 when James Hansen of NASA, the NASA scientist, famously told the United States Senate that in his view, man-made global warming had begun. 4 years later at that Earth Summit, the leaders of the world governments around there was a fight. You know, many of the small island states wanted them to agree to reduce emissions. They didn't, but what they did agree to do was we're going to stop global warming before it triggers dangerous climate change. So global warming, once the temperatures go up, then as temperatures rise, it triggers climate change. Now, so climate change refers to those impacts. Now, those impacts include increased drought, but also increased floods. You're going to see stronger storms. You're also going to see stronger droughts. The scientists call this the intensification of the hydrological cycle, meaning that you're going to see at times stronger downpours, stronger monsoons in Asia, at other times weaker, but it's going to be more intense. It's going to be variable, and these impacts are going to get stronger over time. Another one of the impacts is heat waves. Not just that the temperature is going up, but those spikes, again, the extremes. There's going to be stronger heat waves, longer heat waves, deeper heat waves. Sea level rise is one of the other impacts. It's not exactly a climate phenomenon, but it is related to climate, where, of course, as the temperatures rise, two things happen. You heat up the oceans, and as we all know from high school science classes, warm water expands, so that's raising the oceans. The other thing that happens is that you melt, high temperatures melt glaciers, and so they begin to melt towards the sea. The point here, and this is the key point, when Hansen said in 1988 global warming's begun, there's a lot of pushback from ExxonMobil scientists, etc., a lot of arguments in the United States Congress, a lot of arguments internationally. It wasn't just in the U.S. that governments resisted the idea that we have to cut back fossil fuels. They're the basis of our civilization. But as the 1990s went on, more and more scientists agreed with Hansen. Clearly, the temperatures are going up. So global warming was more and more recognized as a fact. But the key point is that climate change was still seen, even by the Jim Hansons of the world, as a very long, far-off possibility. Maybe in the year 2100 would that global warming begin to create the sorts of impacts that I've described, where glaciers are melting and sea levels are rising. That was all of their scientific papers that suggested that. And so we in the press reflected this in our reporting. This is what the scientists were saying. It's what most environmentalists were saying, for that matter. This was not expected to happen as soon as it did. And through the 90s, and I would argue up to this day almost, well, not up to this day, the 2007 IPCC report changes, but certainly through the 90s and into the new century, the public discussion of climate change took place in what a grammar school teacher would call the future conditional tense. The framework was if, then. If global warming turns out to be real, and if it raises temperatures, and if the climate system is as sensitive to global warming as some scientists think, then we will have a problem with glaciers, droughts, floods, etc. But it will be a very long time in the future, at least the year 2100. So in fact, the opening, I have a little quote at the top of chapter one of my book from one of the world's most eminent climate scientists, from Britain, called Martin Perry. He co-chaired the IPCC Fourth Assessment Report in 2007. And I saw him when he was putting that report together. And he said, you know, working on climate change used to be about saving the world for future generations. Not anymore. Now, it's not only your daughter who's at risk, it's probably you as well. And that is the paradigm shift that has happened. As I say, it was David King who made me realize, and I was still in that same if-then context. I certainly hoped that we would turn off global warming before it happened. I certainly also saw that there were increasing signs that, wow, that doesn't look very good, that drought there in the southeast United States, and that doesn't look very good over there, that the rising storms and flooding that we're having in China. I mean, I'd seen it all with my own eyes, but there was still legitimate scientific disagreement about whether climate change had begun. And most climate scientists still said, we can't call that. It's going to be 2100. Even Jim Hansen, who, you know, is as boldly spoken on this as any scientist I know. I remember Jim said just last year, even a couple of years ago, we did not know that this was going to happen as fast as it did. It was David King who made me understand this. In October of 2005, he was way ahead of the curve, and he basically said that our scientists have now determined that climate change has begun. And they were not looking, of course, in the U.S. at that point, everyone was talking about Hurricane Katrina. A lot of discussion in the press about a I shouldn't say there was not discussion in the press. The press was taking the Bush administration line that Katrina had nothing to do with global warming. But there was a lot of discussion among the environmental world and policymakers and others. Could this be global warming? Well, in Britain, they had had their own wake-up call 2 years before, the summer of 2003. Some of you may remember there was the occasional story in the New York Times that summer describing how corpses were piling up outside of the morgues in Paris. Older people in particular were dying because the temperatures had gone up in Europe, and of course those societies don't have as much air conditioning, for example, and they were taken completely unprepared, and many people died. At the time, the reports were that 15,000 people had died. That turned out to be a gross underestimate. But when I was in seeing David King, he said, look, that was the not only the hottest summer on record, it was the greatest natural disaster in European history. We lost 31,000 people. That is 20 times the amount of people who died in Katrina. And we looked at that, our scientists looked at that, and we have made a huge scientific breakthrough called finding and or detecting the climate signal. They looked at that 2003 summer. He says, you know, if you look at it, it's the hottest summer in modern history, it seems like a quite unlikely event. But if you do a time-dependent analysis and you factor in the role of rising greenhouse gas emissions, we see that there is a rising baseline, that over the last 50 years, as greenhouse gas emissions have risen, temperatures in Central Europe have also risen. And this rising baseline, 0.6 or 0.8 degrees, doesn't seem like a lot. But what happens is as that rising baseline goes like this, of course, weather is very erratic too, but when the rising baseline goes like this, and an extreme event takes place on top of that rising baseline, that's when you get this gigantic leap. So that the summer of 2003 was as hot as the summer, the hottest summer of the 20th century, which was 1947. But he said by the year 2050, because this rising baseline is going to continue, because you remember, as I said, the physics and the chemistry mean that those gases that are already up there in the atmosphere are going to keep warming us up for some time. By 2050, that summer of 2003 is going to be average. It's going to happen once every 2 years. A summer that killed, he said, 31,000 people. That turned out to be an incorrect number, I found out later in my research. It wasn't 31,000 people. World Watch later reported 52,000 people. That wasn't a correct number either. The World Health Organization now has gone back and has vetted all of the morbidity statistics. We now know we lost 70,000 people died across Europe in the summer of 2003 because of that kind of temperature increase. These are some of the impacts that we have got to begin to get our head around. And as I say, you know, David King was making this argument, and as I remember leaving his office that day and realizing that he was saying that, in effect, climate change had arrived 100 years sooner than anyone expected. And that, I think, is a large part of the reason that ourselves, our institutions, our political leaders were still not grappling with this, because it wasn't supposed to happen for a very long time. And we are still quite understandably focused on the front end of the problem. This recognition that came out with the IPCC report 2 years ago, that business as usual, if we continue the business as usual trajectory, you know, this civilization will not be here. Clearly will not be here 100 years from now. We have got to get that trajectory moving downwards towards serious and rapid emission reductions. And so I reemphasize, in no way am I suggesting that by paying attention to adaptation that we stop doing mitigation. There will be no future without serious mitigation. However, equally, there will be no future, especially for the poor people on this planet, if we don't do adaptation, because these impacts are happening now. You've heard about the villages up in Alaska that are now melting into the sea. You've probably heard about a couple of islands in the South Pacific that are now looking to basically move. They recognize that, again, because of this inertia, their land is going to be underwater, and there's very little that can be done to stop that. The oceans in particular have a very long lag effect. It's going to be, we're already committed to probably 200 years of ocean rise. Before I left David King, he made this point, and it's a useful way to think about it, in terms of turning it off. Remember I said that, you know, we cannot turn off global warming anytime soon. We can turn it off. We just have to stop the emissions. But here's a timing framework that may be helpful. He said, even if we turned off every emission tonight, that means all around the world, in China, in America, in Europe, every place, no more cars, no more electricity, or fossil fuel electricity. So close the hospitals, close the factories, you know, an impossibility. But imagine hypothetically that we could do that. Because of the inertia of the climate system, temperatures will still be going up for 25 to 30 years after that. Once there's no more emissions, 25 to 30 more years of warming is locked into the system. So as I was walking down Victoria Street after meeting with King, heading for the river to try and collect my thoughts, my daughter was 6 months old at that point. I was still very new to this whole fatherhood business. And I realized, you know, it's not going to be 25 years. It's going to be at least 50 years, because it's going to take us 25 years to bring down the emissions. So we're locked into 50 years of rising temperatures, realistically. And I realized that my daughter was going to be almost my age before we could turn this off, and that the next 50 years of her life, which is going to be most of her life probably, this problem is guaranteed to get worse unless we find some serious silver bullets out there. And I, by the way, am one of the people, I know it, some of my environmental friends don't like this, but I am totally in favor of silver bullets. If we can find them, you know, carbon capture and storage is not a silver bullet, but there are people who are talking about geoengineering, finding a way to basically take the existing gases out of the atmosphere. There are some benign ways of doing that. There's a very interesting project called the Global Cooling Project, which talks about using clouds to lower temperatures. Somehow we have got to find a way to lower temperatures, because 50 years of global warming, that if that is in fact what happens, the impacts of that, we already know, and the IPCC and the Fourth Assessment Report 2 years ago made them clear. The impacts of that are going to be profound. And that, again, is why I argue we have got to talk about adaptation. Because these impacts are coming. They are going to be particularly damaging for poor people. One place I went on this project, actually with my original, I was a Katrina media fellow for OSI 2 years ago, and they helped to, you helped to send me to Bangladesh, which is famously low-lying country, famously poor, famously flat in the south. And one of the problems that they're having there now is with sea level rise. Now, again, sea level rise, we don't think about it too much because, again, it's seen as this long, far-off future problem. And, you know, it certainly is a serious future problem. If the mitigation doesn't get dealt with, and we have, as Jim Hansen talks about, if we lose some of these, the Greenland ice sheet, you're looking at, 20 feet of sea level rise. That would pretty much, that'd be very hard to deal with. Even if it happens over a couple of hundred years, that'll be hard to deal with. But in Bangladesh, where the seas right now are rising at about 3 millimeters a year, quite tiny, but once you add it up, it is almost well, it's about 7 inches a decade. But the problem is when you're so flat, as that whole delta is, where tens of millions of people are living, what is happening, and I saw this with my own eyes, is that the ocean is slowly pushing farther and farther inland because it's rising. So it's pushing farther and farther inland. And so all of that farmland that's in the south, where they've been growing rice for centuries, is getting salt, more and more salt in the soil and in the water. 20 years ago, it was 3 to 4 parts per 1,000 salt in that soil. Now, it's 20 parts per 1,000 in the last 20 years. And that has made rice productivity go like this. You can still grow rice there, but you grow a lot less of it. And you look at the fields, and the fields are brown. And the farmers are talking about how it doesn't grow as well anymore. And they know darn well why it's not growing as well anymore. They've lived with this for centuries. They don't know about climate change, but they know that for some reason the salt is getting into their land. And, you know, they're adapting as well as they can. They're shifting to shrimp farming, which can tolerate more salt water. But that has other impacts because your average laborer down there, landless, he can't do that. I said before that we have to have a paradigm shift of our own. And this paradigm shift, I believe, has to recognize not just that climate change is the huge issue facing us in the 21st century. I think that message is now quite well understood. But in terms of dealing with climate change, the defining challenge of this century, we have to have a new paradigm. And that new paradigm has to focus on mitigation and adaptation at the same time. And we have to find ways that the one can reinforce the other rather than conflict. I'll give you a quick example of a conflict. When you guys are facing those extra hot days here in New York, what's the common reaction? Air conditioning. But the air condado, unless it is solar or wind powered, is going to make global warming worse. So we have to find ways that are friendly to adaptation and mitigation at the same time. And I'm looking at them. Those wonderful plants outside called trees. Trees are the key to the future of climate change on a lot of different levels, including how we feed ourselves, which is what I was just in China looking at and what I'm going to Africa next week to look at. Trees turn out to be a very, very important tool. Here in the cities, trees will lower the temperatures considerably and will make those hot days much easier to manage. In the rural areas, trees help with drought, and they can raise water tables. That's the story I'm going to look at in Western Africa. So we have to find solutions that are both adaptation-friendly and mitigation-friendly. And the slogan that should guide us, and this is the closing thought I'll leave you with, and I've heard this from a number of different experts, is that our challenge over the next 50 years and beyond is in climate policy. We must avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. Avoid the unmanageable means mitigation full steam ahead. Because if we don't, the impacts that occur will be absolutely unmanageable. Right now, the impacts are serious enough in Bangladesh, in California, where I live at the moment, and in the Himalayan mountains. We're going to lose most of those snowpacks. And those snowpacks happen to provide the drinking and irrigation water for 1 billion people around the world. 1 billion, that's 1 out of 6 of us, rely on those snowpacks. And we're already losing them at a very fast rate. Probably there are things we can do, but if we don't turn off global warming real soon, we're going to lose all of them and a whole lot of other impacts. So we must avoid unmanageable impacts with mitigation. At the same time, We must manage the unavoidable. There are unavoidable impacts now, and we must manage them. We must manage that sea level rise. We must put in place sea defenses and make sure that cities are much better prepared than New Orleans was when Katrina hit it, including your city, by the way, which is overdue for an extreme hurricane. Last one you had was 1938, and luckily you have a local government that is focused on this problem now. But all around the world, I just was in Shanghai, they are really in trouble on this, and they don't quite recognize it yet. So we've got to find ways to put in place the protections against storms, against droughts, against food production declines. And the good news is there are a lot of things we can do. This story I'm going to go do in Africa next week for this project for my book is about as hopeful as you can find. Poorest people on the planet, one of the most drought-ravaged places on the planet, and for 20 years they have been basically regreening the place through letting their trees live instead of chopping them down, pruning them, growing them, and this has raised the water tables and has allowed them to increase their production of grains to a level that in these areas no child has died of malnutrition during the recent hunger periods where deaths have been widespread elsewhere. So there are a lot of things we can do, but we have to start doing them. And above all, we have to change the way we look at this. It is not enough just to go green, as important as that is. We have got to avoid the unmanageable and manage the unavoidable. And these challenges will affect every one of your fields, whether you're working in criminal justice or housing or democracy issues or governance. Climate change over the next 50 years is going to change our world in ways we have not even begun to imagine. It is going to be the big paradigm shift of our times, and we have got to shift along with it. And we can if we start now, because we have a lot farther to go than we think. That's the first advice. They always, all the Dutch, one of the very positive parts of this book is something called the 400-year plan. The Dutch have a 400-year plan to adapt to climate change. And so, people say, when I'm working on this, well, where should I move to? And I think about that a lot for my daughter, who's 4. And I, where should she think about growing up? And I'll tell you, Holland is looking like the best place, even though when you land at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam, you are landing at 15 feet below sea level, right? So when people said all that nonsense after Hurricane Katrina, it's New Orleans' fault. They shouldn't be living below sea level. Well, the Dutch have been doing quite well, thank you very much, for quite a long time living below sea level. You can do it if you put your mind to it. And they put their minds to it. And there's a lot that we can learn from them for how to deal with this. So anyway, I'll stop there and invite your questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mark, for those sobering words. Let's open it up for questions. And once again, if you could speak into the microphone, that would be great, and I'll hand it around.
Hello. My name is Parker Krasny. I work at the public health program here at OSI. And I was just wondering, a few years ago, read an article in Scientific American, I think. It talked about how fresh water from melting glaciers would, I guess, like lower the salt levels in the ocean, which would slow or potentially even stop the Atlantic conveyor, which brings warm water north and cold water south, which would actually then result in creating like Siberian conditions in Eastern Seaboard and Western Europe. And so I was just wondering if there's, agreeing, of course, that climate change is occurring, if there is not consensus over what the actual effects are going to be, how do you go about planning to adapt for it now and putting measures in place to address, the eventual changes that will take place?
That's a good question. That particular possibility of basically shutting off what we laypersons call the Gulf Stream is one that gets a lot of attention from the public because it's so scary. And in the 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report, they basically think that we do not have a high probability of that happening, of shutting off the Gulf Stream in the next 50 to 100 years. But it's not a zero probability. That's clear. If it were to happen, that's one of those tipping points that we absolutely have to try and avoid. Because if you do that, like you say, I mean, goodbye to Western Europe. You're not going to be able to, I mean, the British Isles are inhabitable only because of the Gulf Stream. They'd be living like Lapland. That would be their climate. So we have to hope that we turn this off in time. But, you know, one of the terrifying things, if I haven't been terrifying enough already, is that we fundamentally don't know. That's the real hard one to get around, is that the scientists say we think that it's a low likelihood in the next 100 years. But as I mentioned earlier, nobody expected this thing to come on as fast. And scientists say, look, we underestimated it. And there's a lot of reasons why. A lot of it has to do with the pushback from the ExxonMobil propaganda effort. Scientists are like human beings, like anybody else, and if you're going to get criticized for saying something that's bold, you hold back. And so they were overly conservative. So at this point, that looks like less of a concern than it was 5 years ago, but we don't know. And unfortunately, through the 90s, the fact that we don't know, you know, the ExxonMobil, the carbon lobby, used that to say, oh, we don't know. Well, then how can you expect us to take these draconian cutbacks in fossil fuels? And it's, precisely because we didn't know is why we should have thought about that, the precautionary principle. Anyway, go ahead.
Lenny Bernardo, Mark, thank you so much for this. A couple of things. First, I'm curious how you explain Alexander Coburn. The vast, vast majority, this is a columnist for The Nation magazine, a prominent, I guess he's probably American now, leftist. The vast majority of climate deniers are on the right. He's the only one on the left that I know of who's called into question some of the empirical works being done on climate. I'd like to get some, he's also a native Californian, or one who lives in California now. So
presently, yeah.
So curious to hear what you think about Coburn and how that, and let me just leave it. I was also going to ask you about public policy responses from the Obama administration, but let's just leave it at that.
Well,
sure.
Freeman Dyson as well. And I'll be quick on that because it's the Obama is more interesting. Look, I think in the case of a number of people, I can't explain it with Alex. I've never talked with him about it. I do know that he loves vintage cars. So perhaps the idea of having to, you know, not be able to drive a car that gets 5 miles a gallon is the genesis for it. But he's, and this is true also of Dyson, and Jim Hansen said this, you know, if you do your homework at this point, I don't see how you can any longer deny this. And in Coburn's case, you know, he cherry picks the science, as all of the deniers do. They cherry pick the science. And, you know, in the maybe back 15 years ago, that would be understandable. But why Alex in particular is still on this, I cannot. You'd have to talk to his psychologist, I think. In Dyson's case, I think he is coming from a standpoint of contrarianism, which is fine. And Hansen, Jim Hansen was quoted in that same story in the Times Magazine and regretted he was misquoted, too compressed of an answer. And he sent out a blog later saying, look, Freeman Dyson's a great scientist, and obviously great science requires skepticism and challenging. But it also requires you to do your homework. And Hansen pointed out that Dyson's critique of climate science was largely a critique of the computer models being used. And Hansen pointed out that, look, computer models, maybe that would have been a fair critique in 1992, but at this point, computer models are but one and not the most important data source for our findings. Right now, most of the strongest data for what climate change will do is paleoclimatic data. That means deep, you know, millions of years of human history. And we know what has happened in the past. So if Dyson is going to get into this, you know, keep up with where the party is. We're not in 1992 anymore on this. We now have real-world data that is onto that. But look, there's a great quote that I got from the head of the former head now of the Royal Society of Britain, who was talking about another eminent scientist who was the great denier during the 90s, Richard Lindzen of MIT. And this guy, Lord Robert May, had been a good friend of Lindzen when they were postdocs at Harvard or someplace together. And he says he's so shocked and disappointed that his old friend will not look at the evidence. And then he says to me, but you know what? That's the history of science. In the history of science, when we have these big conflicts, whether it's, you know, around cosmology, does the Earth revolve around the sun, or whatever, the big questions, there's two different camps, and there's that whole, you know, Thomas Kuhn's idea of the scientific paradigm. He says, but what really happens? People don't change their mind. They die off, and the science moves on. And probably that's the case with Alex, too. People get invested in a public position, and then their egos prevent them from shifting. And I would argue that is the last thing that you should do as a scientist or a journalist, for that matter. As a journalist, of course we have biases, but like scientists, our obligation is to constantly be testing our biases, be aware of our bias and test it. And if the evidence points in another direction, you have to shift your view. But you know, people who are not really journalists, who are more devoted towards opinion, they're going to stick with their opinion. Now, as for the Obama administration, which I think is a much, because I'm tired of wasting time on this. This is the deniers, you know, go talk in the corner among yourselves. Let the serious people here deal with, I mean, I'm very angry at them because we have basically, you know, we made exactly the bet that those people wanted us to make in the 1990s. We were going to bet that the scientists were exaggerating this. And we were going to bet our entire future that we did not have to take a more precautionary approach. We did exactly their bet, and that bet turned out to be wrong. And my daughter's generation and kids around the world and ecosystems around the world are going to pay for this forever. And the penalty should be that those people have to be called to account for that. And they should not be allowed to participate in the policymaking in this regard anymore. They have forfeited the right. Or at least you have to explain to us, you know, this is ExxonMobil, explain to us now what you did and how you were wrong. If you want to be let into the room about how we decide Obama policies, cap and trade or whatnot, you come clean on that first. So in that regard, Obama, he inherited a mess, you know, and not just in climate. And as a result, even though his policies are quite good and you know, I think he understands climate change and the threat that it will pose. If you noticed on his, I happen to be lucky enough to be in Chicago on election night and I saw him give his speech. If you remember, he talked about the three challenges that he would inherit as president were the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the economic crisis, and the climate crisis. No president had ever given climate change that degree of prominence. So he gets it. His science advisors are excellent. You couldn't ask for better people than John Holdren and Stephen Chu at Department of Energy and Jane Lubchenco, who's just a wonderful, effective scientist. The difficulty is going to be, as it was under Clinton, convincing Larry Summers and the rest of the people at the in charge of economic policy that we have to do this, and that even in the face of a recession, that we have got to make these kinds of climate changes. I think, again, Obama gets that. He gets it that green jobs and clean energy and all of that sort of thing is an economic stimulus. I wrote in this book that what we needed was something I called a global green deal to fight poverty and environmental degradation around the world at once. And 10 years later, that idea is now kind of a mainstream idea. It's accepted by the UN, by the government in Germany and Japan, and Obama has it, at least in his domestic policy. It's not enough yet, but we're going to invest in green jobs, we're going to make a down payment in weatherization and insulation, and it's going to deal with employment. So I think he gets it, but the real question is he going to play that card strongly enough, put enough money into it, A. And then B, on adaptation, I do not see any evidence yet that the Obama administration gets that, but I would be very surprised if they don't, because John Holdren and Chu, for that matter, and Lubchenco, I'm sure that they are making this case very clearly. Now, whether that will be translated into policies, I'm less optimistic because, again, of what I refer to, there's this sense that what really matters is mitigation. I would argue that if we don't do adaptation well, it will very soon impinge on our ability to do mitigation, because you have to have a functioning society in order to invest in green energy. You cannot have New York taken out by a hurricane and expect that our capital markets are going to properly allocate capital to, which we absolutely have to do, to make the green energy revolution. We need our financial system to be operating. And so New York needs to be protected, like Shanghai needs to be protected, like London needs to be protected, and Tokyo. And London and Tokyo are pretty well protected and getting more protected all the time. New York, Shanghai. So I think if the president were to be more outspoken on adaptation issues, I think that would help. I think I'm sorry to say, politically unrealistic to expect him to do that right now. And I probably, if I were his political counselor, I wouldn't advise that. He's got other things that he's got to push through. But at another level, with Stephen Chu and the others, I do hope that they begin to put much more focus on it. And indeed, in areas like public health, I mean, it doesn't all have to come out of an environmental message. The public health system is going to be hammered by this, hammered. The agriculture system is going to be really in trouble. That's the main focus of my work here at OSI, is how are we as a species going to feed ourselves when the temperatures are going to be going up and the water supplies are going to be going down? There's a lot we can do, but we have to do it. Anyway, that was a longer answer than I should have given, but someone else. Please.
I'm Lee Hollingby from the OSI Library.
How lovely
on the phone.
To meet you.
Nice to meet you. So can you just talk more about how the global economic crisis meets the global climate crisis, not in the United States, which you just spoke about, but internationally, please?
Sure. There was a very good piece in the Financial Times that Al Gore and UN Secretary General Ban did, where they talked about, in response to the global economic crisis, governments around the world had committed, this was in February, I believe it was $2.4 trillion of stimulus promises. And their point was that this $2.4 trillion, serious amount of money, obviously, has got to be invested in a green energy transition. They had a wonderful speechwriter who came up with the line and said, if we put it into the existing carbon economy, it would be like investing in subprime assets all over again. We're going to have, this time, be subprime energy, because we will lock in this old infrastructure, polluting coal plants, et cetera, for the next 50 years. And that would be, a death sentence. So in that regard, I think they pointed the right way. I was disappointed that at the G20 meeting in April, that the G20 included in about 20 in paragraph 24 of a 26 paragraph communique. They made a nod to clean energy and all of that, but it was not at all a priority. And I think that was a real missed opportunity that does not augur well for how world leaders are going to be dealing with this, at least in a collective way. Maybe at the G20, it's simply too difficult to do that. I do think individual leaders, surprisingly, Sarkozy in France, one of the leading voices on this, are recognizing that we've got to invest in green, and if we do it right, that it actually can help pull us out of this slump. But it's a very hard argument to make in the poor countries. Now, having just been in China, the Chinese get it. They do get it. And there's a story on the front page of the Times today talking about that. They recognize that the future is green. And I must say, I also came back from China much more optimistic about the possibilities for a breakthrough, a U.S.-China deal on climate. I think that is very doable. And what would be ideal would be for it to happen before the Copenhagen meeting in December. If U.S. and China said, look, we've got an agreement, and we're both going to do X, Y, and Z, that you would make the Copenhagen meeting almost certainly the rest of the governments would fall in line. And because that's who they're waiting for. They're waiting for the two superpowers. Us and China are the two climate superpowers. And if we can come to a deal, and I can't say much more about this because they were off-the-record conversations, but I can say that there have been very serious back-channel discussions that are, that as someone who's been following this for a long time, I was surprised at the openness, especially on the Chinese side, to get past the past, and that they recognize that they have a self-interest now in dealing with this. So, you know, watch this space between now and December. I think I wouldn't say it's likely, but I'd say there's definitely a fair chance that the U.S. and China could cut a deal. And that would be great. Anyone else? Last question.
You'll be glad to hear that we actually fund one of those U.S.-China dialogue kind of projects on this. I can tell you more about it later. My question goes to several books you've written over the course of your career, and it's about kind of the intersection of media and journalism with the climate issue. As if the science wasn't bad enough, and it's only gotten worse since An Inconvenient Truth. To me, the scariest slides were when Gore or somebody analyzed the way climate gets covered. And so, at the time he said there was like a 90 or 90 some odd percent agreement among scientists that climate change was happening and that it was man-made. And then when the analysis was done of the coverage was kind of 50-50, which goes to some weird thinking in journalism about what objectivity consists of. And I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about how we might get at that problem. Like, what needs to happen so that the good and solid science, and I would argue economics at this point also, because I think there are fewer and fewer deniers on the science side, and they get less, and they have less and less credibility, but on the economic argument side, there is more and more, and that's kind of where the ExxonMobil carbon lobby people have turned. So, you know, what could we be doing, either as a society or even this foundation, to improve the coverage? And, you know, I'm interested in this country, but I'm actually interested in other parts of the world also.
It's a great question, especially the economic side, because you're quite right. At this point, aside from Fox News and the Wall Street Journal editorial page, nobody doubts this now, the science of climate change. I haven't even seen Alex write anything about this recently. But, yeah, right. But again, it's seen, okay, those are those right-wing guys. It's not affecting the discussion of it. But, more to the point, the economics argument, I would say that we are now seeing a replay of exactly what happened on Science on the economics. That the reporters, even in good papers like the Times, which should know better, they are essentially buying the argument that that was the deniers' argument throughout the 90s, by the way. It was their, not only is climate change not true, but even if it were true, it's too expensive to deal with. That is now animating, that is, I would say, the dominant idea that is animating all of the coverage of climate change, or at least a good portion of it. And that is going to be very important right now and on through to this fall and through Copenhagen as the House and the Senate are dealing with the climate bills. And there's absolutely a necessity for someone to call the media out on this. I heard that a guy at, what's his name, Eric Pooley, who used to be at Time, has done a study on this. And I don't think he's probably not as outspoken on it or as blunt as I'm being here. But we definitely need, beginning now, to be saying exactly this. I think that, you know, you guys in the media, good on you for catching up on the science of climate change, but guess what? You're just about to make the same mistake that you did the last 15 years. Don't you want to maybe avoid that this time? I mean, it'd be a perfect thing to do as an op-ed piece, but then not just an op-ed piece. There has to be a kind of a campaign around it. And I know a friend of mine, David Fenton at Fenton Communications, is pushing to have a program, a campaign on this. I think that's quite strategic, and it has to happen quickly because they are defining the debate, and it is a very difficult time for members of Congress to say, oh yeah, let me raise the energy prices for my constituents. So if the debate gets framed that way, which is a false framing, it's going to be very hard to get what we need legislatively. So I totally agree that the frame has to be changed. How you do that is a longer discussion, but I think through calling it out is the first step, and probably through some kind of focused advertising and public awareness and, you know, pressure, the usual stuff that we all know how to do very well and that we've seen it works on other issues, and we have to do it on this one now. And you know, the media, I think there is a real opening for it because they all feel pretty stupid now that they, you know, journalists always like to think that, oh, I'm not going to be fooled by, I'm tough, I'm, well, it's now been pretty well demonstrated that they were very gullible on climate change. So I think there's a real opening there to say, don't make the same mistake again.
Planning On Bended Knee, Volume 2, The Press and Climate Change?
People keep asking me that during the Bush years. They wanted me to rewrite On Bended Knee. I thought I didn't have to do that. Jim Wolcott did a...
Thank you very much, Mark, and thanks to all of you for coming. Mark will be here for this week. And he'll be back in New York in the middle, starting in the middle of July through the first 2 weeks of August. And then again at some point in 2010. Remember, after Copenhagen. Thanks very much, Mark.